There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the bill we got? I mean, the bill we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
And it's Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Turning up your voice. I want to hear what you think. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. It also works as text. Joined here by Dalton Orwig today. So, Dalton, you getting the new iPhone? Put in your order for the new iPhone 10?
No. No, I'm not. Actually, for the first time, I think, was it last year that the 8 Plus and X were unveiled? Was it last year or was it the beginning of this year? I'm not sure.
I believe it was last year because I got my new one just at the end of last year.
It had to have been last year because that was the first time I went and ordered the new phone from Apple, from their website, and where you get the payment plan. It's a subscription for the phone, and basically a two-year lease, and with the option to turn it in for a newer, even better, more expensive lease after 1 year. So I'm coming up on that one-year option to switch up, but there's just no way. They're too expensive, and the phone I have works fine, so I'm going to hold on to that.
So no regrets. You're happy with what you got.
I am, yeah, and maybe I'll go for one of these new ones that they just unveiled, but maybe next year after they're a year old. But then I'm sure they'll have
another one,
the iPhone XX or whatever they're going to come
That's
up with.
That's what they
next.
Do. They wait till the fall and they introduce a new one just in time for Christmas. So like little Johnny and Sally, what do you want for Christmas? Mm-hmm. I want a new iPhone, you know. And all the kids at school got one. Yeah. They know what they're doing. They're very, very, very
it
savvy.
It always works out perfectly for Apple somehow. But with the new iWatch, now that looks pretty cool. And I've never had an Apple Watch, but I've been interested. I've had a Fitbit. I still have a Fitbit. I just never wear it. But I'm interested in the new watch still, though. I'm not sure if I'm going to go in on the watch just yet. Might wait just a little bit longer.
My wife and I, Apple Watches, and I wore it a little bit at first. It was kind of cool to be right down the road and you could pause and stop your music and stuff. You wouldn't have to mess with your phone while you were driving. But it's just more stuff on your arm.
Mm-hmm.
And you're so accustomed to just whipping out the phone and doing whatever you got to do with the phone. I suppose if I were a little more active and actually ran and did all these other things and I needed to like pause my Lady Gaga in my AirPods and yeah, then maybe, but I'm not really sure where the Apple Watch kind of fits in the big picture of all the tech gadgetry you need.
Well, one thing I'm worried about with, and I think in like 10 years, everyone will have some kind of wearable on, whether it's Samsung, Apple, whoever. But I'm worried about, you know, when I get home now, it's hard enough for me to put my phone away. That's become what I've tried to do, is just put the phone away so I'm not bothered by these notifications and I'll find myself getting stuck on Twitter, just scrolling mindlessly through. And I know that's so awful for you and for your psyche. So I've been trying to put my phone away. But if I've got it on my arm and I'm still getting those notifications, and I know they're trying to pare down the notifications and make your life less stressful by giving you less information, but if it's on my arm, I don't know how I will ever truly get away and be wherever I'm supposed to be in my living room or be outside.
Well, the problem with the Apple Watch is just a less useful version of your phone. Like,
yeah.
It has all the apps and, you know, and all the icons and stuff. It's just it doesn't do all the stuff you need it to do. You might as well just, if you're going to waste your time, you might as well just pick up your phone rather than look at your wrist, because the apps are, you know, it has Twitter, but you can't send a tweet. You can just read them. It has, you know, music. You could just pause and start it. It has the iTunes. It has all the things, but just a crappier version of the app. And you're just like, why am I carrying this extra, like, why this radioactivity on my arm and doing God knows to what my health? Just look at my phone. It's just a lot easier, less to keep up with, less to keep charged. So I tried the Apple Watch for a while. Remember they had the Apple glasses?
Yeah. How did those turn out? Well, I think that was Google, right? I don't think Apple did have glasses.
They discontinued them after a little while.
Okay.
Well, people were going into movie theaters and
recording
movies through their glasses, and the movie theaters started having to ban them. And then it got kind of weird. Like, I don't know, like you're looking at you're the Terminator or something, and everything you look at is just, you know, like who needs that, right?
Right.
And you have a little cloud at the top with a Twitter window or whatever, your Instagram, and has cameras on it. Maybe it's just a little too. We're a little too far. Yeah.
All I know is if those do become a thing, whatever glasses you wear where you can see a computer screen through that, there better be driverless cars by the time that becomes popular. Because if people are driving around with the Google glasses or Apple glasses or whatever on, there's going to be some real danger in the streets.
Well, I think the idea was you could wear them while you were driving. And they would help. They would have the GPS built in, and it would tell you turn ahead, and you would be looking at the actual road, and it would show you like an arrow or which way you wanted to go, or it would say danger ahead, traffic jam, or whatever. People just—that's just too much. That's just—it makes life a little too complicated.
Keep your eyes on the road. Actually, when I was wearing my Fitbit, my favorite, I guess, use for that was the silent alarm that wakes you up in the morning. And I would think that if I were wearing the Apple Watch, I would want the same thing. I don't know if it has that, but the battery life, like if I'm wearing a watch, if it's a nice watch, I'll take it off. But if it's a watch that is going to wake me up, I want to wear it when I'm asleep, right? Well, if you have to charge it every 2 days or whatever you have to do for the Apple Watch, then that would end up with me leaving the watch at home when I get up to come to work, and it wouldn't have the silent alarm. So I'm going to wait a little bit on the Apple Watch, but I'm going to dive in before long.
And the charging app, for you, those of you that are completely bored with this conversation about technology, you sit it on top of this thing, and it charges that way. Uh-huh. It's like your Fitbit. You just kind of plug into a thing. But the Apple Watch, it's unique in that it works with nothing else but the Apple Watch.
So okay.
It's just kind of, I don't know, it's just more wires coming out of the wall that you have to, like, figure out where this goes or where this doesn't go.
Well, we do have a caller on the line. I don't know, do you want to talk to this caller? We're going to have to go to him unnamed. It might be about Apple, might be about something else. Caller, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Were you wanting to talk about Apple, iPhone, and watches?
Actually, it was something along those lines. You piqued my interest when as I'm driving and listening to the Apple and the driverless cars mainly. Don't local police departments make quite a bit of revenue and for their salaries and the things that we do from the speeding tickets that they write? Maybe speeding tickets and stop sign tickets. But if we go to driverless cars, won't all that revenue disappear?
Well, that's the problem with, like, with the stop smoking campaigns, and they had all this tax money they were bringing in with the smokers, and then when people stop smoking because of the effectiveness of the, you know, the campaigns, well, that money, that resource, all that money started drying up, so they had to figure out ways to make up for it. And that's why you see this just one after another, they would escalate the cost of the cigarettes or whatever on the taxes. So my guess is if they go driverless cars, I think maybe little by little that speeding ticket that would have cost you $50 like, you know, a few years ago is not going to go up astronomically, because they will probably say there's no excuse for you to be speeding given everything is so automated.
Yeah, and they'll probably have to find I guess budgeting better is out of the question, right? Like actually budgeting.
I mean anything with government, obviously, but couldn't you make the argument, I think, that if you have driverless cars, there wouldn't be necessarily a need for as much public safety on the roadways, at least on the long stretches, you know. Obviously, you probably couldn't get away with it in a place like Mobile, but, you know, my drive from Tallahassee to Mobile on I-10 is just kind of a, you know, after Crestview, it's very barren. Maybe you could kind of cut back on the number of state troopers, and that saves money and you don't need to ride as many tickets.
Yeah, because what percentage of whatever force, I mean, whatever, whether it's the sheriff's department, state troopers, police department, what percentage of them are actually out working the roads for traffic violations rather than, you could just pare that down. That's a good thought.
Well, that was the thing. Now, it was probably about 20 years ago when the state legislature had to get involved and not allow these municipalities that had jurisdiction on the interstates to go out and write tickets. And the way they got around it was the local town just had the sheriff's deputies give them, get to deputize them, and then they were able to go back out there. But a lot of that dried up. Anyway, so this is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's FM Talk 106.5. Jeff Poore filling in for the great Sean Sullivan, who's taking the rest of today off. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. Turning up your voice at 251-343-0106. That also works on text. We're going to deviate from the technology conversation, I think, and go back to a little bit about politics. Bob Woodward's got a new book out, and I the bombshells were released like a week ago before the initial launch of the book this week. And what we learn is, you know, you got the juicy nuggets about Trump and the way he sort of talks about his cabinet members, particularly Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and how he viewed it as a mistake to appoint him as Attorney General. And if he had known that he was going to recuse himself from this Russia investigation, then they would have never, he never would have appointed him to this position, and he could have looked elsewhere. And I think there's some truth to that. But I think if you haven't read the book, your interpretation or your expectations are it's just Trump bashing, Trump bashing, Trump bashing, Trump bashing. But what I would encourage you to do is at least kind of thumb through it or whatever, and you don't necessarily see that he's a corrupt figure. He may be impulsive. He may be vulgar. He may be all these things. But what I think what we're missing is that everything he does is about building himself up and not necessarily personal enrichment. And that's kind of where what we're missing out. What I would say is, though, you get the impression that he's trying to do the right thing. He's almost there. He's not quite there, but he's thinking, I want to do this. I ran on this. I want to fulfill this campaign promise. Meanwhile, and this is where he's really fallen short, he's surrounded himself with a bunch of people that really want, they look at their role as protecting him against himself. So when, all this stuff about papers being taken off his desk, he wants to withdraw from NAFTA, he wants to withdraw from the trading partnership we have with South Korea, he wants to do all these things, and you have this, the White House staff secretary, Rob Porter at the time, I think he left in February, but he's kind of the paper pusher, the head paper pusher in the White House, and he's really the gatekeeper. You can't just show up at the president's office, even if you're the chief of staff or whatever, without getting on the official schedule, on this piece of paper. Everything has to be documented, and that is really the key right there. He's the guy that I think a lot of what's in this book from Woodward, a lot of it came from him, but the point is they have all these people that are trying to appeal to Trump's instincts in ways that aren't necessarily, what Trump's setting out to do. So, for example, Trump will say, hey, I want you to draft up our intent to leave NAFTA, write up a letter. I want to send it out right now. And he goes gung-ho about it. They draft it up, put it on his desk, and then someone, either Gary Cohn, who is one of his chief economic advisors, our Rob Porter will take it off the desk and it goes missing. So this never gets done, and he just continues to talk about it. And the thing is, you would think, well, where did it go? No, he according to this book, and if you want to believe Bob Woodward's reporting or not, then he forgets about it and brings it up again later like it never happened. And so you have all these episodes of Donald Trump coming in, demanding a certain thing and not getting it, and then turning around and having to demand it again and apparently not remembering the first time he demanded it. And this is true with, all these things, but they justify it. Whoever leaked to Bob Woodward, who's, if you don't know, he's of Woodward and Bernstein fame. He was the guy that really was the unseating of Richard Nixon. And ever since Nixon, he's kind of kept a presence in Washington, D.C., and he's maintained these sources. He's built this Rolodex. Every administration since Reagan, I believe, he's written a book about where he's been able to draw in sources and talk a little bit, give a little color to the administration. What I think's going on with Trump is about what we would expect. If you're familiar with just the campaign and all the things you've heard, a lot of them are true. You have a lot of dysfunction. You have a lot of kind of chaos, for lack of a better term. And what's happening here is he's surrounded himself with smart people, and I don't know if they're necessarily the best and the brightest, as he promised in his campaign, but they're people that kind of know how to work the system, and they kind of know how to keep him from doing things that might upset other people. So, for example, the trade deals are doing things like, I think two of the big things Trump wanted to do was take out some of our troops on the Korean Peninsula, number one, and number two was withdraw troops from Afghanistan. If you listen to the campaign, he was talking about all these foreign entanglements and things like that, and he was going to withdraw American troops. We were going to bring our guys home, and we were going to save the money, and we weren't going to put them in harm's way, and everyone was going to be happy. Well, the world's much more complicated than just these sort of campaign slogans and things. What happens if you push this domino, this thing happens, and all these other things start to happen? So they have to try to explain it to him. And you have these actors throughout the Trump administration, and, you know, it goes to the Pentagon, it goes to the State Department, it goes to all over Washington, D.C., and they're having to look to, like, okay, we got to get the president, we got to work him on this angle. Meanwhile, you have competing influences. You have the Steve Bannons, my former boss. You have Peter Navarro, who's sort of a kind of the guy, the protectionist economist in the administration, talking about tariffs, talking about manufacturing and all these things he's got to do. And they're all working against each other. It literally is like an episode of The Apprentice. Like, he does kind of pit these things against one another. And it's really kind of funny when he does it. They'll get upset with this. You know, it plays out like this. And so one of the funny things he does, let's talk about Trump's tweets. They want him to stop tweeting. And they want him not to tweet as much. And they say, well, here's what we want to we propose, Mr. President. Let's set up like a panel, and we'll go through your tweets, and we could make some, and, you know, you bounce them off of you and let you know what you think. And, you know, we just want to stay out of trouble and try to do the best we can to control the news cycle. And he's like, that's a great idea. And he tells them, let's do that. Yeah, I tell you what, guys. Let's meet at 9 a.m. every morning, talk about my tweets for the day, and we'll get on a program. 10 minutes later, he's back to tweeting again.
Wow. Did you get a sense that with all these competing factions in the White House, did you get a sense reading the book that a lot of them want to leave, or that a lot of the people that are working in the White House love the competitiveness and how the chaos, or that they're just kind of like, wow, what is going on here?
A lot of them do leave. Inevitably, it was Tillerson who left, because he just didn't. You go from the CEO of Exxon, where you're treated like a king and you're just getting talked down to by Donald Trump. Who's going to put up with that? Some of them leave. Others don't look at it that way. They don't thrive on the competition. They thrive on the power that comes out of winning the competition. So you have these, like, sort of predators all in this one cage. I think Bob Woodward, or it's Reince Priebus, who's kind of giving an exit interview, and it's like, you got a rat, you got an eagle or a falcon, you got a wolf, you got all these, like, predators. You put them in a cage together, and you're going to have carnage.
Mm-hmm.
What's the ultimate goal other than just being the king of the castle? And that's what Trump has surrounded himself with. He has surrounded himself with all these guys that are just competing to be the most powerful. And eventually you have casualties. You have Bannon leaving the White House. You have Priebus leaving the White House. You have a Secretary of State leaving the White House, having to be replaced by Mike Pompeo.
But is it even possible to put lambs in the White House? I feel like anyone that wants that position is going to fight and has fought for everything they have to get to where they are in D.C. And that if this is just Trump's natural way of leadership, this just happens to be a bunch of wolves fighting it out.
Well, there are some kind of on the peripheries. So one of the key figures in the going back all the way to the campaign and the escalator ride has been Hope Hicks.
Mm-hmm.
She's not the predator. She just has somewhere along the way, given it was the first campaign when Trump first ran, it was just Trump, Hope Hicks, and Corey Lewandowski. She was like one of the original three.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of won Trump over. She appeals to Trump because she's got the looks, obviously, but she does what he says, you know, and she has... Sometimes she has insightful ideas that the president kind of buys into. She's probably one of the quote-unquote lambs, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some others, you know, I'm sure that aren't as big a players. That was the problem with, like, what you have now with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. before that, you had Sean Spicer. He was kind of one of these guys, former RNC guy. He was kind of trying to play the game and be the spokesman. You can't do that. You just got to get on board with the program, go out there and be the face of it, and you could add your input. But don't try to make any big policy discussions. They'll say, Mr. President, I think we should think twice about tariffs. Or you know, stay out of that stuff and just stick to the messaging.
That's interesting. So, I mean, I just assumed that this was a hit book, that it was all about how awful of a President Trump is, but you say that it doesn't seem, it doesn't point to corruption.
No, I don't think it, well, I'm three quarters of the way through, so I haven't completely finished it, but there's no smoking gun where he's actually calling Vladimir and saying, hey, can you help me out in Michigan and get these vote totals? There's none of that. It's all like, it's mismanagement at times, but it's never like, oh, Trump's just this evil guy trying to take over the world. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan on Midday Mobile. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. Area code 251-343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan. Going to close out my portion of this hour. I guess we would be remiss without talking a little bit about the Hurricane Florence and the Carolinas. And, you know, I think earlier this week there was, it's just my impression, maybe there were some people out there kind of hoping that this was going to be a big test for Donald Trump. They thought, well, it was partially to the downfall of Trump, Bush in 2006 was Hurricane Katrina and just the carnage and the chaos in the streets of New Orleans and all these things with the cameras there. And then you have like Kanye West saying Bush doesn't care about black people. And, you know, you fast forward, 13 years, and Kanye West and Trump are buddies, apparently, right? Like, you know, he goes from heel to hero in that span of that time. But I do think that there were some people really looking to make some political hay out of this hurricane. And then luckily, thankfully, it wasn't the category four they thought it was going to be. It weakened as it got closer to shore. But There's a consequence to doing that, guys. When we type up a hurricane and really put it out there as saying this is the biggest storm of our time, and, you know, then on the side you talk about is Donald Trump up to the test, he mismanaged Puerto Rico. I wonder, like, when you hype up a hurricane and it doesn't end up being as bad as it was hyped up to be, if later on down the line, you know, in the next few weeks, there's another hurricane, those same people look at it and say, they just hyped this last one up. They said it was going to be a Category 4. I'm not leaving this time. I am staying put. I am not getting out of harm's way. I can't trust the media. They have ulterior motives. There's consequences to doing that, and people will stay at home and be in harm's way. And, you know, we were talking about this morning about, you know, they have these mandatory evacuation orders and people stay and they have to call, you know, public safety officials or whatever to get out of the situation. Well, that's the reason they don't leave, is because they think they can wait it out. And it's not inexpensive to flee from a hurricane. You got to pay for gas if you could find the gas. You have to sit in traffic. Imagine if you're sitting in traffic with your wife and your two kids in the back screaming and you're in traffic and you don't even know where you're going to go because all the hotels are full. You know, there's nowhere really to go, weather the storm out. You're just in a bad, bad situation, and then nothing happens. You fled for no reason. You come back, and the storm, let's say, went the other direction. That's going to weigh in on your calculus on your next decision, and I think that endangers people. And I think there's a true consequence to overhyping these hurricanes, and then in addition to that element, hyping them for the sake of politicizing them and thinking that you can score some victories against the sitting president. We didn't do this with Obama, but we seem to be going in that direction with Trump. I don't think they were outright doing it, but I do think you could turn on CNN and be like, wow, look at this. This must be a really big, big, big deal, and it hasn't been so far.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like it's better safe than sorry if you are truly in a dangerous spot.
Right.
But I heard it on the way in this morning, on the way into work, once in a lifetime. I feel like they have used once in a lifetime for at least one storm every single year, that this is a once in a lifetime storm. And even though this was downgraded to a Category 2 and Category 1, the flooding is and will be a major issue. But I 100% agree with you that blowing these storms, even if it's the biggest storm you can have, they'll still find a way to blow it out of proportion. And at the beginning of the week, I started getting notifications from CNN and New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And the first one I remember seeing from CNN, it reminds me of when you're walking through the mall and the people that are selling things in the middle of the aisles in the mall and those booths.
Right.
And they try to stop you even though you're clearly on your way to somewhere else in the mall. And it's just annoying. And, you know, I know they're trying to make a living, but that's not why I'm there. That's how I feel about CNN. They're trying to take advantage of me caring about the people that are going to be hit by the storm, but they use just an insane – they build it up so insanely that – I feel used by the time I click on that notification and read it.
And it's twofold there with CNN. Obviously, whenever there's big breaking news, CNN just it rushes past into ratings, MSNBC and Fox News, right? I think they were thinking, well, maybe we can, you know, in addition to getting these ratings and these big numbers, maybe we could use them as kind of a political wedge. And I think that you're setting yourselves up for something really bad to happen in the long term when you do that. And that's why people don't trust the news media these days. They see these things happening, and they think, well, what's the liberal media up to today? It's just taking advantage of a situation, like you said.
And with the Trump stuff, the Trump tweets, and I started thinking about it a few days ago when Florence was becoming a bigger deal, and the whole Trump tweeting about Puerto Rico and how many people actually died and whether it was the Democrats that put that on him. I started thinking, you know, I really hope that the president, that he doesn't, you know, go on like this storm isn't about to hit America, that he doesn't start tweeting about some other big political firestorm without tweeting and making sure that Americans are okay first. And so I went through his Twitter feed just to see what's been going on.
He has
been doing a fantastic job of retweeting, you know, FEMA, the National Weather Service, the Carolina Department of Transportation. So his tweets, he's been tweeting a whole lot more.
But all you see is Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico.
That's all you see in the news.
Well, let me say this real quick. The Puerto Rico thing is obviously a product of just Puerto Rico being Puerto Rico, kind of behind the times with the infrastructure and all these things. I think like 17 people actually died directly from the storm. And all the deaths that have happened since have just been because it just couldn't, you know, the storm caused all these things to happen because they never built up on the island what they needed to be. And people have died because of it. And that's not okay. Don't get me wrong. They need to catch up. But we are in 2018. A category four storm is a bad, bad thing. But building codes have changed. You know, we have infrastructure now that can weather these storms. We have cell towers. We have ways to communicate. We have all these new technological advancements. A Category 4 storm is still a bad thing, but you can kind of survive it. You can survive any of these storms. I guess it doesn't matter what category it is. A lot better than you could in the past. What they want you to do is be aware of it and know where to be. Don't, like, if you live in a mobile home or something like that, don't stay in your mobile home near the coast or whatever. Those are completely logical and legitimate concerns to let people know. But, you know, you're 20 miles inland and they're, you know, talking about voluntary evacuation orders and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then you leave because you just buy into the hype. And you're 20 miles inland, and then nothing really happens. Maybe some limbs fall down or something like that. People kind of get away from that, and they're like, well, I'm not going to listen to the next when something more serious happens.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm watching it right now, and the Weather Channel, I've been infatuated with their coverage, and they've got this like new in-studio virtual reality thing. It's one of the most amazing things I've seen. But the Weather Channel is so far past where they were 4 or 5 years ago, and a whole big part of that has to be blowing some of these storms out of proportion. There's no, like, this is how the Weather Channel makes their money, is right. By making a big deal out of these storms, and but where does it come to the detriment of the American people?
And they have invented the National Weather Service's classification of storms wasn't good enough. They have invented their own like winter superstorms. Yeah. They have decided to go around the public officials and create their own category of storms.
We have some phone calls stacking up, and I apologize, I don't have your names, but we'll try a phone line right here. Caller number one, you there?
Hey, this is David Preston.
Hey, David.
Hey, David.
I wanted to call in and relay a story that a friend of mine who works for the Staten Island Advocate relayed to me this week when I was discussing this on my Facebook page. And he said that the hurricane before Superstorm Sandy came through, you know, they did that exact thing. They hiked up the storm. They said, everybody leave. Everybody get out. It's going to be bad and it's going to be horrible. Well, it kind of ended up fizzling out and not being anything. So when Sandy came along, everybody was like, well, they said that about the last storm and nothing happens, so I'm going to stay this time. And that's why Staten Island ended up having the most number of deaths from Sandy, because everybody stayed because they didn't believe the hype. And then furthermore, you know, the Jim Cantore saying, you know, if Jim Cantore shows up to your town, get out because it's going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Jim Cantore ever came to Mobile during a hurricane, I'd actually track him down and go walk up to him and shake his hand and say, thank you for coming, because now I know no damage is going to happen to Mobile.
That's a very, very cynical approach there.
Yeah, and this is Cantore's 97th storm. I read that this morning. He's 54 years old. He said Florence is his 97th storm, and it was funny. We were joking around. What's he going to do
for number 100?
For storm number 100? I got about a minute and a half here. I think we can get one more call in. Are you there, caller?
Hey, guys. Appreciate it. This is Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Man, I was flipping around and got a hold of you two guys, and I always enjoy the subs y'all have. Darwin knows I enjoy him. Yeah, just quickly, I was flipping through Fox last night, and they had a guy holding on to a pole, and Laura Ingraham said, you need to get away from that thing. You know, that thing's not going to last long. But I'm of the impression, like you said, they cry wolf, and it puts people in danger. But I digress. A couple of the other things I saw, both politically, though, and Jeff might appreciate, is something you never think about is, number one, some of the first ladies have been, you know, in Vogue and these different things. And, you know, really, our first lady now, she's just not, they're not putting her out there. Can you imagine that?
No.
So one of those, you know, that's one of the things. And the other thing you don't think about is people like Google, you know, the socially tolerant party, you know, they're getting rid of positions on a political basis and replacing them with other people. So it's just some of the things behind the scenes that Jeff probably, you know, can comment on. But, you know, us people out here, you just don't think of it until you see it, you know, really happen.
Yeah, that's one of the big things going on right now. We broke a series of videos on Breitbart, just kind of where the Google executives are talking about where they are politically. Meanwhile, they said publicly they're nonpartisan or they're bipartisan. They're not picking sides. And then behind the scenes, it's a really, really like more Democrat and more left than we previously realized.
Yeah, there was crying going on after the Clinton loss, right?
Very, very emotional time. You know? Oh, this is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan. Wrap it up here. Coming up next is Sean talking with Ben Kearns and Taylor Martino. Then following that at 2 p.m. is the Paul Feinbaum Show. I want to thank Sean for having me, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And I'm joined by Ben Kearns with Taylor Martino. Thanks for being in today.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Yeah, it's a lot to talk about here. And first of all, I know Ed, and I know so many of the partners there at Taylor Martino. But Ben, you're a new name to me. Talk about you starting at Taylor Martino, and why did you choose Taylor Martino?
Well, I'm the new associate there, Sean, and I actually started working for them when I was in law school. So I worked a couple summers in law school when I was at Alabama, and Christmas too. You know, it's just really great to be part of a team that really cares about people and cares about our clients. There's a few reasons why I wanted to work there. You know, I was just really impressed when I worked there in law school with the firm's interest in clients.
Yep.
And interest in doing the right thing by clients.
Okay, you were telling me the story before we went on, and you said, so, and it's, people understand, you know, you're interning somewhere, you really get to see the inner workings of this, right? I mean, after about 2 days, there's no, I mean, everybody, you're seeing how it really is at a business. So, and you were telling me, hearing those meetings, talking to the partners, what they thought was important, what was primary to them, and you kind of rolled these out for me.
So, you know, sitting down with partners, Ed Rowland and Richard Taylor and Steve Martino, what they constantly emphasized to me was, you know, you've got to serve the client's best interests. You got to do the right thing by the client. You got to do the right thing by the law, and you got to do the right thing by the rules of professional conduct. You know, I was really impressed by the ethical standards of the law firm. You know, this was something that was really important to me in law school, and I want to practice law honestly and ethically. So this was the right law firm for me.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about if you want to be the most idealistic ever, it would be while you're in law school, right?
That's right.
And you're in there, and you've got a bunch of people that once, you know, a couple of days have gone by, and you're seeing the real workings. It's lining up with your beliefs.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, talk about this with me, because that's, you know, let's talk about being honest and doing the best for the client.
Sure.
Because there's there are people out there that may have sullied the reputation, have worried people about the honesty of the attorney or even their clients.
Well, I think what you see, the image you see of personal injury lawyers on TV and TV shows, is that you see a lawyer who's got a client who's not really that hurt, and he's wheeling them into the courtroom in a wheelchair and a cervical collar.
Sure.
And they're not injured.
Yeah,
but on the day of trial, they sure acting injured.
Right.
And so that's the stereotype. So, you know, one thing that I do in my initial client interview is I sit down with the client and I tell them that we demand honesty. And we want them to be honest with the other side and with the court, with the judge, because justice is best served in that way.
Right.
And we think that you're more likely to get fair compensation when you are honest, because a judge and jury can tell when you're lying. Honesty is the best way to go about it, period.
Yeah, I mean, that's number one, their case, right?
Absolutely.
Getting the best result for them. But honestly, it's for you and a firm, too, that's doing business right here in Mobile for a long time.
Sure.
But your reputation is what it's all about.
And the surest way to lose a case is to tell lie.
You have that meeting and you tell folks, all right, let's get down the real nitty gritty on this.
Right,
let's get down
to
the truth.
Right. Yeah, and it's about doing the right thing. It's about getting fair compensation. It's about winning in the right way. And, you know, there's a law against perjury, and we have to obey that law. And we got to instruct our clients to obey that law. We have to help them to navigate the law and obey the law. That's our job as lawyers. So that's what we do.
Right. And I guess that, I mean, you're going to tell them, okay, here's the law that protects you.
Right.
But let's make sure what you're telling me is exactly what happened so you can apply the right law.
That's right. Correct. Yeah, and we have to know that. Otherwise, you know, later on, if we're hearing a different story, then we've made the wrong argument early on in the case. We got to know right off the bat what's actually going on. You know, what we want is honest clients with honest injuries. We don't want anybody to be hurt, but we want people who really have been hurt and who are really entitled to fair compensation. That's who we want to fight for.
Ben, this is what people want to hear, I think. If you're just joining us, talking to Ben Kearns with Taylor Martino, new associate there, but this is something that if I reputations work in both ways.
Sure.
Y'all are demanding honesty of the clients, because that reflects on y'all.
Right.
But at the same time, if I'm looking for representation,
sure,
your reputation reflects back on the client.
Absolutely. And I think that judges and juries know what our reputation is. And, you know, because they know about our reputation, you know, they're more likely to know that what we're doing is the right thing for the client, and we're telling the truth when the witness testifies.
That's so important. And I'd say here in Mobile, where we live, but probably anywhere in the USA. All right, let's talk about somebody has this injury. Something has happened to them. They've had a loss of some sort. What's the process of sitting down with you or anybody else? How does that work?
First, I got to meet you and I got to see you face to face.
Okay.
And we're going to have to talk. And my meetings, my initial client intake meetings are very thorough, and I take a lot of notes. And, you know, it might last anywhere from an hour and a half. Sometimes I'll come see you. Sometimes I need you to come see me at the office. And we're going to talk about everything that happened. I want to hear, you know, the nature of the accident, where you were that day, how it went down. I've got to tell a story as a lawyer. And so I got to know what the story is. So, you know, I got to get facts and details. And sometimes I'll ask a question out of the blue that the client isn't expecting and they don't know is pertinent. But I got to know it right then and there, you know.
But you know that information is going to be that's going to be necessary. We don't know that. That's why it's good to have the talk with you.
Yeah, when you go to law school and you're practicing law, there's things that we know about this process and about what the law says that the client can't know. And the client sometimes has a different impression of what the law actually is. That's why you need a lawyer to help you navigate that law. You know, otherwise, you know, you're kind of going in blind. You know, you don't want to be represented pro se. That means, you know, representing yourself in court.
Right, right.
We need that legal advice.
Yeah, and that's why you ought to go to school for so long.
Sure.
And
it needs to be competent legal advice.
Yes, exactly. Incompetently. And I like the fact that you're taking notes and these meetings take a while because the idea that I could just go to an online form and plug in a couple things about some accident, that doesn't tell anything.
Yeah, I know it. And you know, we have an obligation to give the client the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that means it's an ethical obligation. We got to tell you know, what we like about the case and what problems are in the case. You know, that's our job, and that's the rule that we have to follow.
Have you had to tell somebody they don't have a case?
I have had to tell them that. And it's tough to do, but you know, you have to do it. But more often than not, we like people to come in and give us the facts so that we can take a look at it and then give them honest and ethical and full legal advice on it.
All right. So if somebody's listening to us right now, wants to do that, wants to, you know, get in touch and then they have the meeting with you, what's the process? Do they call you? Do they call the main office? Do they go online? How do they do it, Ben?
Call our law firm, 251-433-3131, and set up a meeting with me, with Ed Round, with Richard Taylor. Tell us what's going on. I'd love to meet with you, and we'll meet with you at my earliest convenience. We'll have an honest talk about it. Set some time aside. Like I said, I need an hour and a half of your time. And then you're going to have to give me a little bit of time to research, investigate, talk to other lawyers about it. Because when I give you legal advice, I want it to be good legal advice. And I want to make sure that I've done all the research.
Absolutely. Ben Kearns, thank you for being in today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Ben Kearns with Taylor Martino right here on Midday Mobile.
No representation is made that legal services performed are greater than the quality of legal services of others.